Hello, this is Atah Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, July 21st, 2020, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page with Illinois High School Sports defending the name. Sullivan Girls Basketball Great hopes Redskins name remains. This article is by Matthew Flayton from Sullivan. As Becky Clayton Anderson led the Sullivan girls basketball team to a 35-0 record and a Class 1A state championship during the 1990-91 season, she can remember opposing fans deriding her Native American heritage. "I have dark skin, dark hair, dark eyes, and I look Native American, and so I was taunted a lot as a player," said 47-year-old Clayton Anderson. "I can remember vividly playing high schools that would make the Indian noise at me and call me Indian slang names." Clayton Anderson's mom, Savenia Bracklin Clayton, is a member of the Hidatsa and lived on the tribe's reservation in the northwest corner of North Dakota before coming to Moultrie County. Clayton Anderson, who is half Hidatsa, said at first the taunts about her heritage upset her. "I remember crying a couple of times, and my mother told me then, 'Don't let them see you cry. You should be proud to be an Indian and play your hardest and show what you can do,'" Clayton Anderson said. "It was kind of rough for a couple of years." Clayton Anderson played under the Redskins team name while at Sullivan. Although she at times felt discrimination on the court, she found pride in her school's nickname and logo. "I remember the first time that the mascot was protested shortly after I graduated in 1991, and I was asked to come and speak on behalf of my family because at the time we were the only Native Americans in Moultrie County," she said. "If anyone was going to be offended by the mascot, it would be my mom, but she brought us up, I'm the youngest of five, to be proud of our heritage, and to her it was an honor to have a mascot like the Redskins. That's how I was raised." The recent announcement that the Washington Redskins franchise would be dropping its controversial nickname in favor of a yet-to-be-determined alternative has brought the issue of Native American-themed logos and nicknames back to the forefront. Not all Native Americans are okay with their likenesses being used as mascots and take particular offense to the Redskins. Crystal Echo Hawk, CEO of Illuminative, a nonprofit initiative designed to increase the visibility and challenge the negative narrative about Native nations and people in American society, told the Washington Post the Washington NFL team did the right thing in changing its name. "When you really look at what the Washington team name has signified, it is one of the most blatant examples of institutionalized racism in popular culture that has been allowed to stand for decades," Echo Hawk said. "As we saw all the events accelerate over the last few weeks, and when we started to see those big brands deciding to retire, from Aunt Jemima to Uncle Ben's to Eskimo Pie, and down the line, it opened up a whole other level of conversation about the power of racialized brands and imagery and symbols. Chief Illiniwak was an ongoing source of contention at the University of Illinois. Five Illinois high schools continue to use Redskins as their team name, including Sullivan and Nokomis High Schools. Moments, Morris Community, and Shawnee also use the Redskins name. There are other schools across central Illinois and the rest of the state with Native American-related team names and imagery. An Illinois House bill may require a change from those schools if passed. House Bill 4783 would require schools that use Native American imagery to receive written consent from a Native American tribe based within 500 miles and renew the consent every 5 years. Schools would also need to have school-wide programs teaching Native American culture and societal contributions. The bill was put forward by Representative Maurice West, Democrat Rockford, and had a first reading in February and was referred to the General Assembly Rules Committee in June. The bill could affect 52 Illinois schools that have Native American-related team names, including Mount Zion, Tuscola, Neoga, Altamont, and Casey Westfield. Nokomis School Superintendent Scott Doerr stressed the Native American history in the naming of the city of Nokomis. Our mascot was created in 1921 with the full support of the community and based on a local historical figure, Doerr said. Of course, Nokomis itself is based on the Nokomis Indian tribe that settled this area. The Board of Education will review this issue in the near future. Since 1992, four Illinois high schools have modified their team name away from Redskins. Naperville Central became the Red Hawks in 1992, and Marist High School in Chicago became the Red Hawks in 1997. In 2002, Huntley High School renamed its team the Red Raiders, and Chatham Glenwood became the Titans. Sullivan Athletic Director Ryan Aikman said that since the news of the Washington Redskins name change was announced, he has not had a meeting with school administrators about the issue. I'm sure we'll have a conversation at some point, but right now I don't have any other information, he said. I haven't had a conversation with my principal, superintendent, or anybody. There hasn't been any talk of it yet. Amanda Glazebrook was a teammate of Clayton Anderson's on the state championship team and, like Clayton Anderson, is a member of the IBCA Hall of Fame. She said she supports Clayton Anderson's opinion regarding the logo. My opinion on the team name is that I back Becky, Glazebrook said. That's my opinion. I think if you ask any of our teammates, they back Becky too. Clayton Anderson, a resident of Mount Zion, is the owner of Physician's Choice Wellness, a medical weight loss clinic that has branches in Mount Zion, Forsyth, Taylorville, Effingham, and Vandalia. She started the business in 2008 to help people like her mom, who died of complications from diabetes, a disease prevalent among Native Americans. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, Clayton Anderson had secured a grant with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to provide similar chronic disease educational programs for the Navajo Nation in New Mexico. I was set to move my husband and our three younger children out to Navajo Nation, but with the COVID-19 pandemic, things were messed up, and the funds were reallocated, so we are staying in Central Illinois, Clayton Anderson said. Two of Clayton Anderson's daughters, Savenia and Lainey Walter, played basketball as Braves for Mount Zion, and she hopes that future generations play under the Redskins' name in Sullivan. We have so many other things and problems that we are trying to deal with the COVID situation and the Black Lives Matter protests, that there are so many other issues we should be resolving before trying to take away a school's mascot or validate it, Clayton Anderson said. I think people forget about Native Americans because there are very few around still. I think that if we get rid of the mascots, they will become more forgotten, and that makes me sad. And there's a couple of photos here. The softball field dugout for Sullivan Redskins. And then there's a really great photo, large photo, as a Native American, Becky Clayton Anderson, a Sullivan graduate, faced racism on the court, but supports high schools keeping its Redskins team name. The changing of the Washington Redskins football team has restarted conversations about Native American imagery in sports. And Becky is sitting cross-legged with her basketball in her lap. And behind her is a chain-link fence with the plastic inserts that say, "Go Redskins," and then there are colors in a stream behind it. and the colors are red, white, and black. And there's a sidebar here, Central Illinois Native American team names, Altamont Indians, Casey Westfield Warriors, Mount Zion Braves, Neoga Indians, Nokomis Redskins, Sullivan Redskins, Tuscola Warriors. COVID-19 education. Teachers union, don't reopen schools. Group says in-person school teaching requires safety. Peter Hancock, Springfield, one of the state's largest teachers unions, said Monday that most schools in Illinois are not yet ready to reopen for in-person teaching in the fall, and it urged schools to continue operating remotely until the safety of students, teachers, and staff can be assured. At this point, our recommendation is schools should return to online or remote learning after the beginning of the school year, Dan Montgomery, president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers, said during a video news conference. That is the safest and best option. It's safest for the students and their families, and it's also the most practical. K-12 schools in Illinois, along with colleges and universities, were ordered closed for in-person classes on March 15th, days before Governor J.B. Pritzker issued a statewide stay-at-home order in response to the emerging COVID-19 pandemic. They remained closed throughout the remainder of the school year and were allowed to reopen for summer school on only a limited basis in early June, when the state entered Phase 3 of the reopening plan. On June 23rd, as the state was entering Phase 4 of the reopening plan, the Illinois Department of Public Health and the Illinois State Board of Education released guidelines for the resumption of in-person classes for the upcoming 2020-21 academic year. In-person instruction is strongly encouraged in Phase 4 as the guidelines state. However, it is critical to note that this does not signify a return to pre-pandemic operations. Appropriate social distancing, face coverings, enhanced sanitation measures, and other accommodations will be necessary to ensure the safety of students, staff, and their families. Those guidelines require, among other things, use of appropriate personal protective equipment or PPE, including face coverings, prohibiting more than 50 people from gathering in one space, observing social distancing as much as possible, monitoring all individuals for symptoms of COVID-19, and an increase in school-wide cleaning and disinfection. But IFT issued a statement Monday suggesting those guidelines do not go far enough. In addition to the measures IDPH and ISPE recommended, IFT called for districts to negotiate their reopening plans with their local teachers' unions, allowing a blended model of in-person and online learning that would limit class sizes to no more than 15 students at a time, giving teachers authority to decide what the best model is for their students, and requiring a 2-week quarantine for any student or staff member who tests positive for COVID-19. Montgomery said there might be some schools in the state that are able to meet those standards, but most districts right now are not able, we believe, to hit the benchmarks in terms of social distancing, in terms of all the PPE and cleaning, he said. Beth Anderson, who teaches special education in Kankakee, said her district has developed a plan that gives parents the option of putting their children in in-person classrooms, online learning, or a combination of both. However, we feel a great deal of unrest because we're not sure we can really implement the plan for any length of time, she said. This summer, we've already experienced both staff and students testing positive, even with practicing all the recommended guidelines. IFT has more than 103,000 members who teach in public, private, and charter schools, as well as 21 community colleges, 9 public universities, and 1 private university. Its announcement Monday came nearly a week after the 135,000-member Illinois Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, issued a similar statement that called for ensuring that all schools have adequate cleaning supplies, PPE, face masks, and social distancing protocols. No one wants to return to a school more than those who have chosen education as their profession, but it is also professional educators who understand better than anyone the impact a contagious disease can have on a school population, the statement read. Asked about the reopening plan at an unrelated event Monday in Peoria, Pritzker said he expects every educational institution in the state to approach the task differently. In some cases, schools are going to choose no in-person school. In some cases, it'll be mostly in-person school, he said. But what we've said is make sure you've got at least the hybrid available. And for kids, and there are plenty of them, who are immunosuppressed, or kids who are in families where there's somebody at home who is immunosuppressed, they may stay home. They may not be, that may not be what they need to do. Macon County Board, County Treasurer under fire. This article's by Scott Perry from Decatur. A special meeting that began with questions about the delays processing property tax payments ended with thoughts those delays could be grounds for removing Macon County Treasurer Ed Yoder from office. John Jackson, chairman of the Macon County Board Finance Committee, asked Yoder toward the end of the sometimes contentious meeting if he was familiar with the state statute regarding the removal of an office holder from office for cause. Responding that he was, Yoder went on to say, "I don't know of any law I have broken." Jackson then alluded again to the delays reconciling property payments and depositing them in the bank within 2 business days. Jackson said during the meeting that he, as one of those taxpayers whose check took more than 30 days to process, there was some disagreement over whether the 2-day requirement was a mandate. There also was a dispute over the number of distributions that are required. The office currently makes 3 annual property tax distributions. While the law reads a distribution every 30 days is a recommended process, Ed Baggett of the county attorney's office said the Illinois Supreme Court has long held that it is a requirement. While it was noted that payments from taxpayers are lagging some $15 million behind last year, meaning the amount that would be available to them would be lower, committee members said the delay processing payments exacerbated the problem for local taxing bodies strapped for cash. Board member Jim Gresham alluded to the emails received from the Village of Mount Zion and the Decatur Park District about their July 9th distribution being some 40 to 50% lower than last year's total. The special meeting Monday was called after a meeting last week when some it should be someone or something. The delay issues came to light. Responding to the desperate situation taxing bodies are in, the committee directed Yoder to make distributions every 30 days rather than waiting until the traditional second distribution when the funds are fully distributed. All right, we move on to page A3, local and state. Council wants commercial use input. Tony Reed, Decatur, plans to rezone property on a street leading to one of Decatur's most beloved parks are on hold for now after city council members raised concerns about opening up a residential area to light commercial use. At issue was a proposal by city staff to rezone 1326 to 1336 West El Dorado Street, the current home of Temple Benai Abraham, and the adjoining address of 1308 West El Dorado Street, now housing Decatur Fire Department Station 3. The proposal would have allowed both land parcels lining the road that leads to Fairview Park to be shifted to B1 status, opening them for retail development like small shops. The council voted 5-1 Monday night to table the rezoning for 30 days to provide time for more public comment and to see if there is a chance the temple property could be sold for residential rather than retail use. The request to rezone the temple had come from the synagogue's own membership, which is desperate to sell the building. The city plans to replace the firehouse with a new station on nearby Fairview Plaza, and city planners believed rezoning the fire station site to B1 would make both land parcels more attractive to buyers. Gary Geisler, one of the leaders at the temple, said the synagogue membership has declined so rapidly that selling the place is the only option we have left. "I can tell you it is with sorrow that we have come to the point where we have to sell the temple," he told the council meeting hosted in the auditorium of the Decatur Civic Center. But the council was persuaded by the argument of Councilman Chuck Cooley, who voiced concern about rushing too fast to alter the character of the West Eldorado Street approach to the park. "I am not going to change the dynamics of going into the park," he said. Councilwoman Lisa Gregory agreed, "This is one of our legacy parks, and we should give serious consideration to the way that looks when you enter in that street." In other business, the council did vote to approve rezoning property at 5 Southland Drive and 11 Isabella Drive from single-family residence to B2 commercial district to promote business development. Meridian Ag Program gets $15,000 boost. Valerie Wells, Macon. "At the moment, the only visible evidence of the upcoming agriculture building at Meridian High School is an empty space and a sign. However, thanks to private donors and a $15,000 boost on Monday from Agricultural Cooperative Evergreen FS, the school district has raised $540,000 of its $816,000 goal toward making that building a reality." "We're cashing that baby," said Dwayne Noland, a member of the Meridian Ag Foundation, the group spearheading the fundraising effort when he saw the giant ceremonial check. "We're going to run that through the Niantic Bank. That's beautiful." Meridian was the last Macon County school to get an agricultural program and an FFA chapter, Noland said. "Last year was the first year with new teacher Jerry Brockett. About 25% of Meridian's 300 students enrolled for the classes, which included introductions to agriculture, plant and animal science, and agribusiness courses. With the new building, there will be space for a shop where students can get hands-on instruction in welding, carpentry, mechanics, and electricity, a classroom, and a greenhouse. The hope is to have bid documents ready in the next few weeks and to break ground in the fall with a goal of having the building complete and ready to use in time for the 2021-22 school year," Nolan said. "In the future, we're offering a horticulture class to prep for greenhouse management and production sorts of things," Brockett said. "And with it right here next to the middle school, we might have some middle school ag classes in the future. An endowment was left to the school by Dell and Evelyn Carroll, which provides Meridian students with 2 years of tuition to Richland Community College. About half of Meridian graduates already take advantage of that, and the hope is that Richland's ag program will be a destination for the ag students who find their calling in the ag classes at the school." Jeff Smithers, chairman of Richland's agriculture department and a member of the Meridian Ag Foundation board, said students have several choices when studying ag at the college. "Students can come to Richland and get an associate in arts or associate in science, and it's articulated with four-year institutions that offer ag degrees," he said. "The other option is a two-year degree in agronomy or agriculture business or horticulture. He came to Richland to build the program, and now is a good time for that," he said, "because with Macon County schools offering ag programs to high school students, it's an easy transition to Richland to further their studies." Evergreen donated seed for a hayfield at Meridian, which provided education for students in the cultivation and baling of hay this year, and the school also has a garden with sweet corn, gourds, squash, and pumpkins. Students worked in that garden, planting and cultivating, and the pumpkin crop will provide community families with jack-o'-lanterns this fall. And there is a photo here, a couple of photos. Big one of a student holding the large ceremonial check. Meridian High School agriculture teacher. Oh, it's not a student, it's a teacher. He looks so young. Teacher Jerry Brockett talks on Monday about the proposed Meridian High School Ag Tech building. The Meridian Ag Foundation has raised $540,000 to build a 4,800 square foot classroom, shop, and greenhouse for the new ag education program. Meridian Principal Eric Hurlbrink on Monday talks about the proposed Meridian High School Ag Tech building. Two shot, one seriously in fist fight turned gunfight on Friday. Tony Reed, Decatur. Police said a Decatur man has been arrested in the wake of a fist fight and a gunfight that left two people injured, one of them with life-threatening wounds. A sworn affidavit from Decatur police said the 22-year-old man was arrested Friday evening, the same day the violence happened, and was jailed on a preliminary charge of unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon. The affidavit said the man had gotten into a fist fight with another man in the 1000 block of North Clinton Street. Writing in the affidavit, Officer Adam Siefman said the 22-year-old was armed but handed his gun to the 19-year-old to accomplice before fighting. Siefman said the 22-year-old describes the physical fight taking place before his opponent called out to a friend watching the struggle. The 22-year-old said his opponent told his friend to blow, indicating the opponent wanted his friend to shoot, Siefman added. At that point, the affidavit describes the 22-year-old's accomplice pulling a gun and opening fire first before the opponent's friend returned fire, hitting the accomplice. He was taken to HSHS St. Mary's Hospital with life-threatening injuries and a woman standing nearby when the gunfire broke out was also hit. Police later described her injuries as serious but not life-threatening. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland told the Herald and Review Monday that police are still searching for the other man who opened fire. The affidavit did not describe what had prompted the fist fight between the two men, but said the 22-year-old is a convicted felon who is not allowed to possess firearms. A check of Macon County jail records Monday showed that he is being held with no bond available. All preliminary charges are subject to review by the state attorney's office. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half hour. Please join us shortly as we take a little break. We'll come back with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. We'll be right back.